Welcome to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Hi, I'm Carol Bissett, a crime writer, and I invite you with my co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson, each week to our conversations on all things murderous. Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of Only Murders in My Mind. With me today, I've got my co-producers, Liz Hedgecock. Hi, Liz.
Hello, Carol.
And he's back.
Yay!
Michael Jackson. Hi, Mike. You all right?
I'm fine, thank you, Carol. Nice to be back.
We have missed you, haven't we?
We have.
There was a space where there shouldn't have been a space. Well recorded.
I've often been called a space. usually an empty one.
No, you were poorly and then you had a holiday, didn't you?
That's right. Yes.
So there's a lot of it about, that's all I'm saying.
Oh, also, for people who are in the Warrington area, hoping this podcast goes out before the actual event, there is going to be a literary festival in Warrington in June. Mid-June, mm-hmm. And we are part of it. I think it's the 15th of June.
It is.
Yes, there is going to be a sort of a local author event at Warrington Central Library. So if you want to come along and see us,
yep.
Watch out in the media. I think it's 11 till 3.
Yeah, both Liz and I will be there, mm-hmm. with our selection of books, mm-hmm. happy to talk to people and answer any questions that we can. It should be hopefully a good day. We want to promote our libraries because it's use them or lose them, folks.
Mm, that's certainly what it is. Like bookshops.
Yeah, mm. but especially independent bookshops.
Yes.
As our good friend Bob was telling us.
Indeed.
So this edition, we're going to get going in the minute. We're going to talk about Arthur Conan Doyle, a fascinating character, and about his most famous and most repeated and most recycled character, Sherlock Holmes. We all like a bit of Sherlock. I've got a few facts here and then I'll pass it over. Born in 1859, please contradict me if I've got any of these wrong, and his first novel was A Study in Scarlet, and that was published in 1887.
Yeah, I think that was the first published one. There might have been something else that came.
I think he's had. I was looking on Google recently, and the list
meticulous research on this podcast.
The list of pamphlets, poems, stories that he wrote that were never published is extensive, and the list of those that he had published is even more extensive. He was a prolific man in terms of his writing. He really was.
Something about Victorians, particularly, I think.
Yeah.
What about writing, you mean?
About being sort of polymaths and being into lots and lots of different things, you know, in a kind of, I suppose you'd sort of say Renaissance man, but, you know, the Victorians really did a lot of that. And if you think of someone like Dickens, for example.
Yes.
Same sort of, you know, finger in every pie.
Yeah. Really?
Oh, yeah.
I think it probably helps that Dickens and Conan Doyle both got into these sort of weekly magazines, where they were writing short stories or series. So they were under some sort of deadline.
Yes, and there were monthlies as well, and there were so many magazines where, you know, fiction was wanted, which is something you just don't see so much now, which is a real shame.
Well, I think it's all online now. People try to promote their stories and things like the way they would have promoted them in a piece of newspaper.
I mean, I suppose my thinking is back then when you had the big monthlies like, you know, Blackwood's or Beaton's Christmas Annual was a big one. I'm trying to think of the others now. Cornhill.
Strand?
Yeah, Strand, the Cornhill.
I think it's what Conan Doyle wrote.
Yes,
he did. Yeah.
And the thing is, you'd probably have, you know, a star serial by someone very, very well known that people would just buy the magazine just for that. But then you had lots of space for other people. And I mean, it would be a great chance, wouldn't it, for a new author to maybe, you know, have their first serial in something like that and kind of work their way up the billing, kind of like at the music hall. Yeah. Well, you might be there with your talking dog and then eventually you get to top of the bill.
Yeah, one of the things I found out was that when he decided to, he got fed up, he got bored with Sherlock.
No.
And when he killed him off, apparently 20,000 people cancelled their subscription to The Strand.
Ooh, I bet he was popular with the editor. Ooh, can you imagine?
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to say, the more popular you were, the more demand there would be for you. Yes, I went on a course in in London, designed for people who wanted to write for women's magazines. And it became very obvious. It was only a day course. It was very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. But it became obvious at the end that it was as hard to get into that particular genre as it is to get an agent.
Yes.
So that you can go down the traditional route of publishing. So I suspect back in the day, do you think he earned much money from writing for those magazines?
Ooh, not at first. I did my own research. No, he got, for a study in Scarlet, for all rights, he was paid 25 quid. But that was like nearly $3,000 in today's money. Yes. So actually, okay, you know, that's not so bad. And he did another, I think Sign of Four was for the same publisher, Wardlock. And I think he thought, I've been done here. So he parted company with them from that point. But one of the interesting things about him really not liking writing Sherlock that much was that he basically like kept putting his price up, thinking eventually they're going to crack and say, okay, we can't afford you no more Sherlock. But they just kept paying it. So he was actually one of the best paid authors around.
Oh.
Because he raised his prices.
And that was his out. That's how he was going to get out of doing it, as far as he was concerned.
Yep, and it just didn't work.
Poor man.
Apparently, when he said he was going to give up, his mother was one of the ones trying to talk him round to carrying on with it.
Indeed.
And apparently his final problem, which is where he killed, was the killed Holmes off, is when he plunged to his death at the...
Reichenbach Falls,
Switzerland. Just on a slight tangent, I've been to a hotel next to the Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland, and it's all Holmes orientated.
Oh, I bet
you know, it almost implies that he stayed there. It's a fascinating place, it really is.
Mm-hmm. But then, of course, he came back.
Yeah, but you know, it was 8 years. Mm-hmm. The gap between was years.
I didn't realise it was that long.
Yeah. And do you know what the book was that he came back with?
It was The Hound of the Baskervilles.
What a comeback.
If you're going to come back with a bang.
What a comeback. Because I know in elementary, what's it, the name of the falls?
Reichenbach.
Yes. That is a person in that series.
All right.
Oh, I like that.
Who is plotting Sherlock's fall. See what I did there? And in Sherlock with Cumberbatch, he falls off the top of a building, if you remember that bit.
Yes,
yes, I do.
Yeah. And all the people are trying to figure out how he comes back to life.
Oh, I love that when they even get Derren Brown involved.
Hello! So, it's the interpretation.
And they address some of the weird fan theories, which I thought was excellent.
I really did enjoy that.
He's going back to what Liz was saying too, because one of the things I read, when he did the Hound of the Baskervilles, one of the reasons he did that is because apparently the British and American publishers were offering him so much money, he couldn't say no.
We've seen that before, and we see it now, don't we?
Yes.
The film that shouldn't have been made.
Yeah. I wish I could say this has happened to me when I've been offered so much money that I couldn't possibly decline.
Oh, one of the ladies at my fan club asked me if Netflix had been in touch with me yet about my Warrington Detectives. And I did say, when it happens, I'll take them all out for Prosecco.
Apparently, when he did pack up with writing Sherlock, it's because he wanted to do more writing with regard to spiritualism, which is a favourite of his.
Yes. Yeah. I've got a little bit about his religious beliefs or lack of them. He was originally brought up as a Christian, and he went into spiritualism and the occult. He found it much more interesting. One of the things that I found interesting personally was he was a supporter. This bit I don't go with, but of compulsory vaccinations.
Oh yes.
I'm glad he was a supporter of vaccinations, but we know from history that compulsory vaccinations don't work. I found that interesting.
Don't compulsory vaccinations work, Carol?
Because people in countries where you've had the right to say yes or no to things do not take kindly to being told they've got to do something. We tried it with the smallpox vaccinations back in the day. They were even paying people to have them, and people were going, no, I don't want them. And it's been the same in other countries. There was a huge outcry in Canada because of it. And again, I think that was smallpox, the vaccination, not the disease.
I suppose it's not that new thing of, why are they forcing me to have this? What's wrong with it?
Yes. Yeah.
So people start thinking, well, you know, they wouldn't be forcing us unless there was some kind of ulterior motive. Yeah. Now, what could it be?
I mean, we tend to think of sort of anti-vax as being a modern thing, and it's not. It goes back to when vaccinations were first brought out.
Conan Doyle was a doctor.
Yeah.
He trained as a doctor. In fact, there's a lovely piece there. He opened up his own practice, and he said he spent more time waiting for somebody to go in his waiting room than actually seeing anybody. Yeah. I think that's where he spent his time writing.
Was he at Southsea?
Yes. Yeah, he went with another colleague, didn't he?
I think he started off in Plymouth, and I actually walked past the building where it would have been, but then I think he moved, that fell through, and he moved to Southsea to set his own one up, and that didn't work either.
No. Oh, but yeah, he was a Catholic and he became an agnostic and then became very involved in spiritualism and the occult. And we know the story of the pictures of the fairies, isn't that linked with
Cottingley? Yes.
Cottingley.
In
fact, he wrote
my
a book
other half
called...
comes from around there. So yes,
and he wrote a book called The Coming of the Fairies, which is all to do with the Cottingley one.
Yes.
Apparently, he went across the whole world giving lectures on spiritualism.
Yes.
And the other thing is, he was involved in another hoax in a sort of a way. Piltdown Man.
Yes.
Lots of people thought it was him, but it was not.
Oh.
Well, he played golf round there, you see.
Ah.
And also, I think he'd been in the papers quite a lot because people had been taking the mickey out of his spiritualist stuff and scientists had been having a go. So lots of people thought, who's got an axe to grind? You know, who's frequently around there? And apparently he even gave a lift to the hoaxer in his car. So,
I mean,
there we go.
Yeah, in terms of the spiritualism, again, something I read that after he died, there was a big memorial service for him in the Royal Albert Hall. Thousands of people went there. And during the ceremony, Estelle Roberts, who was one of his favourite mediums, gazed at a chair reserved for the writer and said in a loud voice, "He is here."
Oh, I love it.
Yes.
But he couldn't have a Christian burial, I believe.
I think there was some controversy.
Yes.
I don't know if he got one eventually.
Yeah.
Well, I think he ended up in the New Forest.
Yeah, it was somewhere
eventually.
Obscure.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't realise what sportsman he
was. Yes, he was. Cricket. Yes.
Very good at cricket. Mm-hmm. Shot. He was in a rifle club. Amateur boxer.
Yep.
Didn't know that. Yep. Golfer. Well, you've already said he was a golfer. Billiards, and he also took up skiing as well. So
there must be something about mystery writers and sports, because you've got Agatha Christie and her surfing.
Yeah, so I can imagine her.
I'm just seeing the titles of Hawaii Five-0, and, you know.
We won't go into Woman what our sporting prowess is around this table.
No.
I think unless it's tiddlywinks, I'm out.
Yes.
I'm a very...
Apparently, his skiing, they reckon he's one of the first people to actually introduce other people in the country to Switzerland and skiing.
Yeah. Well, it still is quite an expensive sport.
Oh, yes.
But it was definitely an elite sport then, from the fact that it was, you had to be rich to do it.
So do you think Sherlock was funding his skiing habit?
I think he must have been, yes.
Never mind pin money.
His doctoring wasn't. That's really
no, sure. Good job he could write, really.
Apparently he stood for Parliament twice.
Yes, he did. I found that out as well.
And I always thought he got his knighthood, you assume, don't you, he got his knighthood because of his writing of Sherlock Holmes. And
so
he didn't.
What was it?
He got it because he wrote a non-fiction pamphlet about the Boer War.
Right, okay. None of us knew that.
Yeah, no. He's got his knighthood for that.
Yeah. And he also dabbled in some true crime.
Yes, he did. Mm. Yes, a couple of cases, weren't there, that he was involved in.
As a consultant detective?
No, he got involved, I think, because he spotted what he thought was a miscarriage of justice. There was a guy called, was it George Adelji? I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But he was accused of all sorts of really quite unsavoury... things around, like, you know, hurting animals and things like that. But the thing is, the guy was arrested and imprisoned, but the attacks carried on even when he was in jail. But the police were convinced it was him. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle stepped in.
There was another one, and again, I can't remember the name, but it was in Scotland. And apparently Conan Doyle had come up with all sorts of fresh evidence to say this guy had not done whatever he was in prison for. But the Scottish authorities took no notice of it. But apparently this guy eventually was released and claimed something like £6,000 compensation,
that
which would have been a lot of money.
A lot of money, yes.
A heck of a lot of money, yeah. Yes.
So that set him up. I don't know whether it made up for the time he'd lost. But yeah.
If you're interested in the George Adalgie case, by the way, Julian Barnes wrote a very good novel about it called Arthur and George, and I believe it was adapted for TV. So
that does ring a bell.
Search it out.
Yeah, that does ring a bell, yeah.
Mm. Should we talk about the man himself? The other man himself.
Sherlock.
Mr. Sherlock.
Go back to Conan. Do you know how he died?
I'm going to look at my note. Heart attack.
Yeah, in the garden.
Holding, I didn't know that bit.
Holding a flower.
Oh, what a way to go.
And his last words to his wife, which he whispered to her, were, "You are wonderful."
Oh,
what a romantic. A man very much like myself.
See, I'd have expected him to be, you know, involved in some kind of, you know, very dramatic thing, given the rest of his life.
Yes.
So, yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, Sherlock Holmes, I doubt whether there are many people on the planet who haven't heard. Lots of people think he was a real person.
Yes.
Well, this debate about whether he was based on a real person.
Well, he was very closely modelled on Joseph Bell. Is that correct? Who was Holmes's tutor. He was a professor at the College of Medicine that Holmes, that Colin Doyle went to. There is a saying that's. I think it's well known that he was. He based him on that.
Yeah, Robert Louis Stevenson, I think, picked him up on that and said, "Could that be my friend Joe Bell?"
Right, and he said, "Yes." You're all right there, Mike.
And my chair is suddenly. Ooh.
Don't fall back.
Gosh, it did. Scenes.
Sorry about that,
Joe. Scenes. See, all the drama here. You get podcast chat and you get drama.
Yeah, so Sherlock Holmes. Who is your favourite incarnation, Liz, of Sherlock? Have you got
that's
one?
So difficult. Well, I grew up with Jeremy Brett.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for lots of people, he is the definitive.
Yeah.
I would say if you're looking for traditional Sherlock Holmes, then Jeremy Brett.
Yeah.
I really like Johnny Lee Miller in Elementary, but I think possibly it being in New York is a bit, I don't know.
Is it pushing it too far?
Possibly. So, I mean, for me, I really like, for a modern interpretation, I really like Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock. Although I think some of the scripts, it did feel like it was jumping the shark.
Yeah.
The first episode, though, oh my, that was so good. I mean, we watched it. And then I think the next night we were like, what are we going to see? And we're like, do you want to watch Sherlock? Yeah, we'll watch that episode again because it was that good. I can't think of anything else I would rather watch than that again, even though we watched it the day before.
Yeah.
And you can't say that about many things.
No, you can't.
Mm. How about you, Carol?
I like Cumberbatch very, very much. And then I got hooked on Elementary. Mm. And I have watched the complete series at least three times from start to finish.
Wow.
I probably could start quoting the script. his character is really, really good. And his Holmes, who is Dr. Watson, who is a female doctor. Mm. It's just a different take on it. And I found it absolutely. I'm with you about Cumberbatch. The first two series really, really enjoyed, and then you're right, the last one or two I'm like, what's going on here?
Yeah,
you know. But that was script, that was somebody rewriting.
The performances were still brilliant.
Mike, have you got a favorite show?
I think Cumberbatch is mine. I just loved his, like, the whole interpretation, you know, that sort of modern interpretation, and with his thinking coming up on the screen as these little sorts of his equations and thoughts and whatever. I thought it was
when he
very
goes
clever.
Into his mind palace.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's very clever.
Yeah, I like that. The one in Elementary, he tends to put his thoughts, he'll print everything off, and it's all plastered all over his walls in his quite big apartment. No, it's a brownstone in New York. And he'll be going around, and I'm thinking, poor trees, there's another tree gone. Yeah.
I think it just shows the quality of Conan Doyle's writing, though, that you can get these modern interpretations and they still fulfil the purpose of giving you a good mystery story.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Why do we think Sherlock is so popular? Because obviously he is.
I think it's the combination. I think it's the quirkiness of Sherlock and the sort of down-to-earthness. That's all right, down-to-earthness.
It is now.
Of Watson. Mm-hmm. You know, that they complement each other, even though they are so very different, the pair of them.
Yeah, the polars apart, aren't they?
Yes.
In the way they
it's
think.
It's that kind of odd couple thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think Sherlock is, talk about thinking outside the box, you know. The way Conan Doyle's mind must have worked when he was going through some of these clues and, you know, that sort of thing. I'm like, wow, that really is incredible, you know. And you'll go, oh, well, he's obviously got dirt here because, you know, he's out, he's not really doing very well at the moment. And, yes, he's probably separated from his wife because his collar's dirty and all those sorts of things. I'm going, that's incredible. And the person he's saying it to is going, does he know that?
Yeah. The crazy thing with that is, I mean, I'm just watching a program, American one, Monk.
Oh, yeah, I love Monk.
And he's Sherlock Holmes, in a way.
Yeah.
But nowadays, we almost dress that up, and we wouldn't have done back in Sherlock's time, with Monk being very sort of ADHD or very autistic or whatever. You know, he's got these sort of having to always wash his hands and what have you. And you can almost imagine those sort of tendencies is what
Sherlock wouldn't shake hands with somebody if he thought they were he didn't. You there's quite a few different
very offhand.
Oh yeah, yeah. People have put their hand out and he would just stand there and look at them.
Yeah.
But I definitely think there is this side of them of being on the autistic spectrum, the character.
Yeah.
And the way they view things because they don't empathize with the person, the victim or the victim's relatives. It's all facts and this happened and that happened.
I think some of it is he thinks of himself as a detecting machine.
Yes.
Almost. It's like when Watson says something. I think it's something to do with the solar system. And he's amazed that Shaw doesn't know that.
Yeah.
And he says, well, now I know that. Yeah. He says, well, now I know that. I'm going to do my best to forget it. And he's like, what?
Yeah, I don't need that information.
It's like, you know, that's useless to me. So out it goes.
Mm.
Yeah. But in some ways, that is where the two come in together because Sherlock doesn't engage with people.
No.
So you've got Watson there who's sort of following him up to apologise for his behaviour. He's not always this rude. Or, you know what I mean?
Oh, he is.
And with Monk, he's got that Sharona, that nurse of him, who sort of follows him around saying, oh, I'm sorry, he didn't mean not to shake hands with you or he didn't mean to do that.
Yeah.
It's that that odd couple, as you say.
I've just started rewatching.
But Sherlock
Monk
is genuinely fond of Watson.
Yes.
Doesn't show it often, but he does genuinely.
The only person I think he really cares about, even his brother.
Yeah. Oh,
he's not keen on him.
Yeah. Well, they're an interesting pair, aren't they?
They are.
I think he likes Mrs. Hudson.
Yes, he never wanted any harm to come to her. He used to. Yeah, if there was a threat to her, he'd be the first person to defend her. But
I think some of it is, you know, the quirks and the mannerisms and him being so far ahead of everybody else that, you know, he can't even, you know, they're so far back there he can barely see them.
Yeah.
In terms of the case.
You know, the possibility that he could be wrong about something, it doesn't enter his head. You know, if Watson said to him, well, are you sure about that? Of course I'm sure about it. I wouldn't have said it otherwise. You know, that sort of, it's just, I suppose, it's refreshing to see a genius at work.
Yeah, I'd love to have known more about Conan Doyle. You can pick up all these quirky facts about him, but you wonder how how meticulous he was in his day-to-day behaviour, or was it all in his writing? And certainly when you look at the amount of writing that he did, he wrote plays, he wrote poems, he wrote lectures, and lots of them. So he must have been a very meticulous man in terms of his planning for these lectures. He was giving lectures across the world, as we always said, on spiritualism. Mm-hmm. So he must have been a very organised and meticulous person.
And he had someone to organise.
Or he had somebody to organise.
Yeah. I don't want this episode to end without us reading some Sherlock-related stuff. And I know, Mike, you found a poem.
I did indeed.
That he'd written.
Conan Doyle wrote.
Ooh.
There are lots of poems. If you go onto the internet, he was, as I said before, such a prolific writer, which I didn't realise. And some of the poetry he wrote is very long.
Oh, gosh.
A lot of it is towards the war orientated. You know, he had this pamphlet on the Boer War, so that he must have been very heavily involved in researching and looking into all that.
He lost a kid in the war.
So, oh, right.
I think it was the Boer War. I think that came later. But yes.
Yeah. But I found this one, which I thought was quite amusing. But then again, I got a strange sense of humour. So, and it's called Little Billy. Do you want to read it?
Yes, please.
Oh, yes.
Little Billy. The doctor came at 1:30. Little Billy saw him from the window. The doctor, he was short and fat. He hid a trumpet in his hat and spoke with his ear. You may all doubt that, but Little Billy saw it from the window. The doctor left at 4:30. Little Billy saw him from the window. The doctor's head was white and bare, like an ostrich egg in a nest of hair. The marble bounced right up in the air when Little Billy dropped it from the window. The doctor came with a small black bag. Little Billy saw it from the window. And what do you think it had in that? Why, a great big howling, yowling brat with a voice like a discontented cat. Little Billy heard it from the window. And that's how the new brother came. While Little Billy waited at the window, who would have thought that Brother Jack would yell like that? They ought to pack him into the bag and send him back, said angry Little Billy at the window.
I like that. Oh, I do. I really do like that.
Oh, there you go. Now we know where they come from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he has a sense of humour, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
As well.
Oh, yeah. No, I do like that. And we have here with Liz, somebody who, again, has re-looked at the Sherlock stories and sort of reinvented them in her own voice. Would you say that was fair?
Oh. I've written some kind of, I suppose, Sherlock adjacent stuff. I mean,
yeah.
There are an awful lot of people who write Sherlock spin-off fiction.
Yeah.
Too many to name, probably. If you're interested, then in the traditional kind of, I suppose, reimaginings of Sherlock, there's a whole series of them. It's the MX Publishing books, MX as in the letters MX, and they basically call for stories every so often, and the royalties from that go towards one of Arthur Conan Doyle's houses is now a special school called Stepping Stones at Undershaw, and all the royalties from those go towards that to help them.
All right.
So I've contributed a couple of stories, and there are people who've done lots and lots and lots and lots.
Oh, that's interesting.
But yes, there are an awful lot of people out there who reimagine Sherlock in all sorts of ways, from very traditional, very much sticking to the canon, to all sorts.
Would you put that under the heading of fanzines, or is it not that really, is it? Some might be.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a difficult call with fan fiction, I suppose. I've never been entirely sure where you say, well, okay, this is a parody or this is a rewriting or this is fan fiction.
True.
I mean, how do you say that? Because, you know, you have people trying to think, Sophie, someone who writes further Poirot novels.
Mm.
I mean, you know, do you say that's fan fiction or do you say it's a continuation?
Yeah, where do you draw that?
There's books like Death Comes to Pemberley. I mean, there's all sorts of Pride and Prejudice reworkings, from the kind of the, you know, more spicy ones, shall we say, to you know, ones which are reasonably faithful to the original. And I mean, do you draw some sort of line or do you say, well, it's a continuum?
It's yeah It's a story in the same mould, if you like.
Yeah.
Have you got something you want to read? Sorry, Matt.
I was just going to ask Liz, I think I've asked you this question before, Liz,
as
to whether or not there are any copyright issues if you're writing in the style of
Conan Doyle. With copyright, I'm pretty sure it's now the case that it's all now in the public domain. There might be a very few left, but I don't think there are many.
Right.
The copyright has been expired in this country for some time, but because it's plus 95 years after the author's death. So I think that makes a difference in the US. Because here it's 70 years after.
Was it 70?
I think it's 70, unless they've changed it while I wasn't looking, which is possible. I think there was someone quite litigious who was associated with the estate who was basically trying to, you know, go after. Mm. I mean, I think particularly films and TV shows in a kind of, well, you know, they've clearly got money, so, you know, pay us something and we won't bother you. Type way, but I think the Supreme Court actually had to rule on it and say, as far as we're concerned, this is now out of copyright. So yeah, the Smithsonian actually did an article on it a good few years back, because I researched this before I started writing, thinking, well, you know, if this isn't if this isn't something that I can legally do, then I'm not going to do it.
Due diligence, isn't it?
Yeah, but there are so many books out there and so many versions of Sherlock that's
be difficult, wouldn't it?
It would be very difficult.
So you've got something to read for us from one of your books, please.
I have. I thought, you know, Sherlock. I like Sherlocky things, so yeah, I'll bring something along. Okay, so this is from the opening of, it's actually the second book in my Mrs. Hudson and Sherlock Holmes series, and this book is called In Sherlock's Shadow. And this bit, for people who haven't heard me going on about this series before, it's basically done from the perspective of Mrs. Hudson, who here is quite a young woman. And it's a slightly different relation between her, Sherlock Holmes, and John Watson, because here she is the chronicler, not Watson. Although in the stories, Watson, of course, has got his role to play. So I'll read you the first scene of this. And basically, they've got an unexpected visitor. The doorbell pealed as I was pouring the coffee, and a thin dark stream slid down the side of the china cup. They're early. Why are they always early? Sherlock jumped up, wiping his mouth with the napkin. Leave it, Nell, there's no time. Shall I give it a minute? Billy called up from the kitchen. Please. Sherlock was already bounding up the stairs to his consulting room, where I suspected he would spend the remaining seconds before our visitors were shown upstairs, making it look untidy. Dr. Watson rose from the table. I shall sit in, Mrs. Hudson. He brushed down his waistcoat and left the room at a march. Come on, ma'am, Billy Stage whispered from outside the door. I need to let him in. All right. I smoothed my hair, though the action was pointless, and hurried upstairs after the two gentlemen, giving thanks for the solidity of our front door. As I reached the landing, I heard murmuring from the consulting room and a low chuckle from Sherlock. Shh, I hissed as I passed. My hand closed on the cool brass doorknob of the adjoining room, and I whisked in, closing the door softly behind me. As was customary when Sherlock expected a visitor, the gas lamps had been lit and turned low, and the curtains closed. I edged through the trunks, the boxes, the cases of chemical apparatus, and took a cushion from the window seat. I crossed to the wall and listened. They were still talking, and Billy's voice almost drowned the creak of the stairs, a sort of final warning. I must hurry. I dropped the cushion on the floor in front of the bookcase filled with criminological histories and knelt. I drew out a fat Morocco-bound volume, Lombroso's Criminal Man, and put my eye to the chink of light its absence revealed. Sherlock was in his usual chair, leaning back, his fingers poised in a steeple. Dr. Watson sat upright, a notebook open on his knee. However, his chair had been shifted forward so that I could not get a clear view of the empty armchair. Doctor, I whispered. Dr. Watson's shoulders stiffened, and he glanced in my general direction. Please could you move your chair? I can't see. Dr. Watson got up and moved his chair back a foot. How is that? He mouthed. A little more. He moved the chair back as much again. Thank you. He sat down just as Billy knocked on the consulting room door. I could see the gleam in Sherlock's eyes even from my hiding place. Come in, he called, and though he looked almost bored, the note of excitement in his voice was impossible to miss. He was on the hunt, ready for the chase. I looked down at my crossed fingers. hoping that he would not be disappointed. And that's the end of the scene.
Very good.
Yes, I can recommend these boots. They're all very good. You. I've enjoyed all of them.
So. I kind of wanted to bring out the kind of, there's an element of performance in all of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, so. I think it captures the feeling of the time and the Sherlock myth, if you like, even though it's been told from a slightly different perspective. I like the fact that it's Mrs. Hudson that is the main character. Because I've read a few of them, I know her backstory and how far she goes along that road of being a detective herself. So I think we're probably towards this. Anybody else got anything to contribute to our Sherlock edition?
Just to say to our listeners out there that if you've not looked on Only Murders in My Mind blog, and on the blog you can get a link to the podcast, obviously, but I've also started putting up there a weekly writing prompt. And it's a picture writing prompt. And if you'd like to have a go, we'd love to look at your stories and hopefully might even, with your permission, of course, read some out on the podcast.
Yeah. So if you look on keep meaning to do a story for that, and I just, So one day when I've got time, it will happen.
There'll be a link to the blog in the show notes.
Marvelous. Yeah, because we've only so far read one listener's story out, and we really enjoyed doing that. So there's an invite to you to join in and be heard on our podcast if you want to. If you just want to write it in, send one in and we can give you a little bit of feedback. That's fine as well if you don't want it read out.
And they don't have to be murder mystery.
No.
Any story at all. We're quite happy with.
It's narrowing the field if it has to be murder mystery because it's not everybody's cup of tea. And I do like a good murder.
Yes.
We hope that people listen to this from who read all sorts of different genres. And on that, if you want to subscribe or like, please do. We're really happy that you're finding this interesting. You keep coming back week after week. So until next Thursday, we'll all say goodbye. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production, produced by John Bissett. The music in Peril was composed and recorded by OM Studio Strings.